You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 482. The movie industry is brutal. It is dangerous. It is, for most, soul-destroying. Creating art, music, books, films, etc. can be a beautiful and liberating thing to do. But trying to sell art? Well, that's the movie business. There's a few winners and lots of losers. Ronnie Apotheker.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, today on the show, guys, we have film producer Wayne Gottfried. Now, Wayne has produced over 125 independent films, working with directors like Martin Scorsese, Robert Rodriguez, Jackie Chan, Joe Carnahan, Taylor Hackford, Robert De Niro, and many, many more. He has invested more than $300 million across aggregated production budgets that exceed over $1.25 billion over the last 3 to 4 years alone. Now, Wayne and I sit down and talk shop, talk about what it really takes to get your movie financed, what the marketplace is looking for, how he got into the business, and the truth of what it takes to make it in this business. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Wayne Gottfried. I'd like to welcome to the show Wayne Gottfried, man. How you doing, Wayne?
Alex, really good to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you so much for being on the show, man. I'm excited to get into the weeds with you about your very interesting career so far in the film industry. And you're a young guy. We're of similar vintages, but you know, you've done a lot for a guy of your age, and what you've done in the business is pretty extraordinary. So, but before we go into all of that, how did you get into this ridiculous business?
Oh wow! Well, you say I'm a young guy, but yeah, I can't even remember that. So no, it was I was fortunate enough to start as a runner. So I began really my whole career at a post company in the UK called Goldcrest, one of the post houses in the UK. And, you know, I started one day by knocking on the door, putting my CV in, needing a job in, you know, in London, and trying to really figure out what the whole concept of movie making was all about. And I actually was a bit of a DJ back then, so I was very interested in sound and the behind the scenes of finishing movies, and began being a post runner at Goldcrest in London. and from there learned about the business of making films. And I had fantastic teachers in John Quested, Tony Murphy, Stephen Johnson, who were these old school, indie film guys who were, expert teachers of showing how to take a movie, take it to a market like Cannes, package it up, and sell it to a bunch of buyers and actually monetize what a movie is. And this was a whole new world for me as a young kid, because mm-hmm. we just movies, you go and buy them, you didn't think about how they got there in the first place. And this was a whole new kind of education. And so that's how it all began, really as a runner, right from the bottom up.
Now, so the concept of like packaging a film and making money with a film is so... I mean, look, the film business is the only business in the world where you could spend $100 million on a product and it's worthless. I mean, it's the only like you spend $100 million on a building, you got a building.
You would think, and also a lot of kind of thought and market research and care and probably pre-selling goes into identifying whether you should spend $100 million on that building in the first place.
Right.
As opposed to maybe developing it in a little silo. With a few of your mates thinking this is a great idea. But I think, there's different ends of the film spectrum. The $100 million blockbusters are immense businesses in their own right.
Of course.
I unfortunately am not in that arena. I've never been in that arena. It's an amazing arena. They make amazing movies, but I'm in the other end of the mm-hmm. arena, the sure. film end. But whether it's $100 million or $1 million, it's still a significant amount of money mm-hmm. that you are, I don't want to say gambling, but you are rolling the dice on really, putting together these businesses and establishing whether or not can you find an audience. And that's a very interesting proposition. And, I think as a producer, you're ultimately creating businesses. Every film is their own business.
Right, exactly. Because, you could spend $1 million on a movie, but it's like you need when you build a cookie, you bake a cookie on the smallest spectrum. You make a package of cookies. You need to find a customer base for that cookie. And generally, most human beings on the planet will enjoy that cookie because cookies are cookies. It's sugar, it's flour, it's milk, and all that kind of stuff. With a film, it's so more complex. And now in today's world is even more complex because, and as I'm sure you know, from the moments when you started off to today, there's a few more movies in the marketplace now. So it's been diluted with a lot of, for lack of a better word, crap, from a lot of things that might need to be there, might not need to be there. But even if they're all amazing films, it's still a tremendous amount of content that you're fighting for attention. So how do you kind of break through with some of your projects?
Just to that point, I think the other thing to think about is you're not just competing against the new round of movies. Oh. You're competing with every movie that's ever been made ever.
So Jaws, Star Wars. Right?
It's all available at a click of a button now for free or very affordably with the streaming subscription model. So suddenly this incredible shift in consumption that's occurred over the last few years with the plethora of movies that are available, the catalog, as well as the new content, it is incredibly competitive. Mm-hmm. But that's a great opportunity as well, because whereas the barrier to entry was, quite high to make mm-hmm. a movie and actually get distribution and get your product out there. And in some respects now, the availability of resources and technology and reduction in cost of making movies has enabled really independent filmmakers to really be able to tell a story and find an audience and find a home, which wasn't so easy five, 10 years ago. But again, the key question is how do you identify what story is the right story to make and how do you stand out in the crowd? I guess that's a key question. And unfortunately, I don't have the exact answer. If I did, I would be making a lot more of those movies.
But that's the thing. There's no real formula. A cookie. Yeah, a cookie's a recipe. It's not hard, and it's been done a million times. It's now just about maybe some nuances and marketing and packaging and things like that. Maybe some new ingredients and things. But movies, every movie's a new beast, a new thing.
Look at it as Alex, like the three pillars of every movie. There are you need three pillars. Well, you don't need three. You need two. Story is the star. I don't really care how much you're spending on it, who's in it. If your story is golden, you have a chance. But it's a bit wobbly. You've only got one pillar. So you need another pillar. And that will be maybe capital, money, investment, budget. So if you had a load of money and a really good story, but no one you know in it, you've got a, you know, you've got a shot. You get that third pillar in, which is your talent, your recognizable names, your quality director, whether they're new or old. You know, you've got a solid foundation of building the bricks of that house. Three pillars, a foundation of a great chance of making a successful movie. Now, you move one of the pillars or two of the pillars, you had a load of money and no story and no talent, you can make it. It's a bit wobbly, but you might get it made. Similarly, you could have the best actors in the world, no story, no money. It can be challenging. So it's all about finding the right dynamic and the right, the balance of story, talent, and capital.
Right. And let me ask you. So I get asked constantly by filmmakers about how do you get money for your movies? How do you raise financing for your films? And I always tell them a very similar thing to what you say is like, you know, it all depends. And there's also the genre involved here. So there's that other pillar, which is genre, because if you have all of those things and it's a drama, it's a much tougher sell to sell it internationally. It depends on this talent, of course. That's the thing with all of this stuff. It's all variable. Meryl Streep's in it, but I've seen movies with Meryl Streep in it that don't do money in the box office, even though it's Meryl Streep and the story was good and things like that. So what advice do you have for filmmakers who are trying to raise financing for their $500,000 budget movie or $250,000 budget movie or $1 million budget movie? What advice do you have in today's marketplace, which is pretty insane for financing?
It is. I mean, that's a really good question. I think there are a number of variables that one has to consider with what's the best advice for that question. So the first thing is, what is the budget level? What are you trying to achieve? What are your expectations, both for you as the filmmaker and for your investors? So that's a very important thing to start with. Just like any business, a movie is a business. You are starting a new company. So this new company has an objective: make the asset and distribute it to hopefully generate a return on investment. So what is the most efficient way to make it? What is the right and appropriate budget level? That is a normal thing that people kind of jump over. Some movies are made too small and some movies are made too big. What is the appropriate budget level for the movie? And that is very much an equation of where is its home? Where will it land? Where do you think the best opportunity is to monetize the movie? We are in a golden age of distribution with the streamers and broadcasters, but that doesn't make it any easier to license to them or to sell to them. You still need a quality story. You still need to package it. You still need to potentially have a great execution. So, but you know that your upside is capped. You've not got that box office, super sky high potential return. You pretty much have a limited or capped return when you license to a streamer because they buy it for a fixed amount of money. And doesn't matter whether one person watches it or, you know, everyone watches it, you're pretty much getting that a fixed amount of money. So what is your expectation for the movie? What is the direction of travel? And I think raising capital in this market requires, it's never been easy. Let's be honest. It's never been easy to raise money. So you have to look at, in my view, it's always about, my whole approach has always been about offsetting as much risk as possible for any investor or lender entering into an investment in a film. As a strategy, the hat I wear has always been low risk and kind of a get in, get out and do another one. And it's a different strategy. And it's not the only strategy, not the best strategy. It's just the way that my head works. I always look to pre-sell or to offset risk with any kind of quantifiable revenue stream, which may affect my upside. It may reduce the potential of the home run, but it is going to certainly reduce the likelihood of a wipeout.
So use that analogy. I love the home run analogy because so many filmmakers go up to bat and they're always expecting the home run. They're always expecting the box office hit. But what's not sexy is the bunt.
the single, the base hits, stealing a base, pushing another man to base. At the end of the day, you have runs coming in, runs coming in. Is it as sexy as a grand slam? Is it as sexy as a grand slam with everybody on base? No.
I'm seeing people buying T-shirts with my name on it, you know, and making it all my autograph after the game. And I'm not really into baseball, so I can't really play the analogy as well as someone else could. You know, if it was football, soccer,
I got it.
I'd be all over.
But
you're absolutely right. I'm the guy who's just going to get on first base every time, but every time. And as opposed to one in 20, I get a home run, which will be great in that 20th, but the 19 before have been hell. Now, it's okay almost if one in 20 covers the cost of the 19 before, because if that's a strategy, a portfolio approach where we'll put in X amount of money in seven movies on the basis that one or two will hit, the rest might not, but the one or two will cover in spades all the other investments. That's okay as well. It's just not really how my head works. So I've always gone for the ones, the singles. Get in, get out, get our money back, and go again. And that's one of the reasons I think that, you know, I've had a lot of, there's been a lot of movies that I've been involved in.
Yeah, it's an obscene amount. It's an obscene amount of movies you've made.
Because I don't have that kind of, you know, that emotional attachment to these movies. While I'm in them, they're still my babies. Don't get me wrong. I love them. But they're not about, you know, nurturing this little child to fruition forever and then living with it and never letting it leave the house and, you know, staying till they're a teenager and thinking, gosh, is it ever going to leave? You know, I'm kind of like, get out the house, go, move on, want another one.
No, I completely understand. But I have to ask you because, you know, my show and I've been known to, you know, talk about the darker side of distribution, which is the predatory distribution companies.
I've heard some of your thoughts.
You've heard some of my thoughts? Okay, so yes, you've heard of a few of them. So
I was also listening to your fantastic audiobook as well. Oh, really enjoying.
Oh, thank you. Which one?
The talk about the hustle.
Oh,
the film latest one that you're promoting.
Filmtrepreneur. The Filmtrepreneur?
Yes, Filmtrepreneur. Oh, yes. It's terrific.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I'm assuming with 125 plus projects you've done, you have been paid on time perfectly from every single deal you've ever made from every distributor.
I mean, literally, sometimes they just send me money. I don't even ask for it. It's absolute pleasure. It's a pleasure.
So if anyone listening, there's a lot of sarcasm right now running in the room. So how do you, what are your experiences when, and I'm assuming early on in your career, probably, I don't know if you still run into these problems now, but earlier in your career, I'm sure you had to deal with issues like this. And I'm sure you probably dealt it throughout your career.
Yeah. And it's not an issue that is, you know, isolated to any one individual. It's just the way the industry works. You know, as you've said, and I hear you talk about it, we live in a very opaque industry. With studio accounting. I know you use that reference.
Hollywood accounting, yeah.
Hollywood accounting. And, you know, I mean, we'll talk about it soon, hopefully. But, you know, one of the kind of drivers of starting Purely, my latest company, was because of my frustration with the lack of transparency and the opaque reporting and the kind of, well, just the we're dealing with millions of dollars of assets, as you talked about at the beginning, high-risk ventures that require millions of dollars of investment. You spend years developing and making projects, living with them every minute of the day, and then you hand them over to a distributor and you don't hear anything for months, if not years. And then you get a one-page statement that's your report that says nothing, with like a few lines that has no detail, and you're thinking, I spent 8 years of my life making this thing, and this is what I get?
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't make sense. Nothing makes sense, and it drives you mad. And so, yes, I have a little bee in my bonnet about the quality of reporting. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't some fantastic distributors
who are
honest and respectable and communicate,
yes.
And there are. And I've worked with a lot of them, and they are fantastic. And, you know, I always try and gravitate to those sorts of individuals in all walks of business life, because mm-hmm. people that communicate well in good, bad, or indifferent tend to be good people to work with. Mm-hmm. Even if it's bad news, you're hearing about it. It's a difficult, difficult thing. And I appreciate as well that if you're juggling a lot of distributions and lots of different films and reporting that comes from all these different sources are not instantaneous. So getting transparent reporting, not even just distributor, but from the various retailers or sources of distribution are all very bitty, complicated, different formats, blah, 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 blah. It's hard. It's complicated. So I acknowledge that, but there has to be a better way. And likewise, as creators, as participants within a movie, whether you're, you know, an actor, writer, director, costume, you know, if you have a participation movie, it should, you should have a, in my view anyway, a regular and transparent view on how that asset is performing. And, you know, you find about things so late, Alex, that, you know, you can't do anything to change the life cycle of that asset. What's the point of getting a report 9 months after the release to be told it didn't quite work in this way because the marketing wasn't very good? If it was, if you knew about it in real time, you might be able to do something about it.
Hell,
you might not. In
real time, just like just within 30 days. Within 30 days, yeah, would be nice.
So Purely actually was, you know, one of the things that Purely kind of, my company, Purely Capital, was, you know, really came out of this idea that we deserve better transparency. We deserve a system where you can see how your assets are and be more, less opaque and more open and be more inclusive with all the beneficiaries around an asset, within reason, of course.
Right, exactly. And so within Purely, Alex, Purely, so how, explain what Purely Capital is and what it's doing and how it's kind of changing the game a little bit for distributor, for filmmakers.
Well, one of the challenges in this changing face of consumption is we are licensing content increasingly to streaming platforms. And you may or may not be familiar, or your listeners may or may not be familiar, that actually when you license to the likes of Netflix, Amazon, Disney, Sky in the UK, Viacom, Comcast, all of these guys, they pay you a license fee, but typically over 2 to 5 years. So you can end up with quarterly payments, contracted payments, that take quite a long time to get paid. And that is killer. If you've gone and raised that $500,000, $2 million to make that indie film, you know, you've slogged to do that. You know how hard it is to raise that money, but you've achieved that goal. You've made that film. You've then done the holy thing of selling it, licensing it to Netflix, Amazon, Disney, whatever. You're winning. And then you decide, and here, you've got to wait 36 months to get paid. It's like, oh, this is hard work. So Purely was designed to basically completely accelerate that. So we basically give you the money today and we wait the 36 months for Netflix, Amazon, Disney to pay. So we crystallize that contracted income as soon as you've contracted with that SVOD platform or broadcaster, and we accelerate the money to your bank account today. So you can refinance your investors, you can go and make your next movie. If you're a distributor, you can go and buy more assets. So to basically keep those businesses, keep these people moving, so they don't have to keep waiting for long-dated contracted revenues. And that's what Purely is all about.
And that's brilliant, because I've heard this. I've heard the same stories from partners of mine who've sold to Netflix and to all the streamers. And you're like, okay, we got 100,000. Great. Yeah, they're going to start paying at the end of year two. And it's going to be over the next 4 years, and it's going to like trickle in little by little. So that 100 grand will essentially be maybe 10 to 15,000 a quarter or something along those lines. And you're just like, you'll grow old before you get all the money. And it's like, oh my God, this is brutal.
And it's like you write that email to your investors like, hey, congratulations, sold right to Netflix. And like, oh, by the way, I can't pay you for 3 years. It's like, oh, what a bummer. So, you know, I witnessed this problem firsthand. You know, we had the great, and you know, it is a great, you know, achievement and feeling when you license to a great home. And this not critical on the business models of Netflix, Amazon, Disney. You know, we understand that they have to spend, and they are spending, billions of dollars on content to serve their global consumers and subscribers with amazing amounts of content. So if you're lucky enough to be selected and chosen, it's brilliant. But waiting for money just is a pain. It doesn't matter what walk of life, you know. You don't want to chase money. You don't want to wait for it. And that's what we're trying to solve, and trying to find a way to do that in with technology, with efficiency, with a standardized approach that creates a it's super easy for any rights owner, producer, or distributor to just crystallize that revenue stream. And it doesn't matter if it's 100 grand. You know, we can do, you know, small amounts of money all the way up to significant millions of dollars at a time.
Right. And then I'm assuming you take a percentage of what, like, where's the rub as far as you
eat? I mean, come on.
Exactly. So, but the service,
We do a little discount. It's very competitive. It's bank pricing, but yes, sure. We discount money. So we give you 95 cents on the dollar type thing.
Right. Which, I mean, I'll. Right. That's the difference. So like, okay, you can wait 3 or 4 years, or I could pay you 5% and I have it all now.
Yeah. Effectively,
exactly. Whatever that way. Yeah, it's something small. And then now you're like, okay, great. So now I have that 100 grand. I can then repay my financers and my investors. And now they're happy because they got their money back. And they're like, hey, can I do another one? Because I promise you, if you call them up and go, hey, I'm waiting for 3 years to pay you. Oh, yeah, I have this other project. They're going to go, yeah, that's nice.
or call me when the money's back in 3 years if you still have the project, you know.
Right.
So that's it. But you know, these are real world problems. Cash flow is a real world problem. And also the time cost of money. The money in your hand today is worth more than it is in 3 years' time, because you can do things with it. You can make more films. You can make more money from it. So, you know, we're trying to help. But there's more to it than that, Alex. And this alludes to the hunt of transparency and opaque nature of reporting. The whole system is fully transparent. So one of the strategies we're developing in the verticals is to plug in all your revenue streams and provide an instant kind of real-time reporting system for films, not just from the distributor, but from the ultimate retailer. So you can see how your assets are performing in real time and then disperse to your beneficiaries also in real time any collected revenue. So really trying to change this idea of having to wait weeks and months for not money, but also reporting and information, and trying to give it in the palm of your hand on your iPhone or your Samsung, wherever you are in the world. You can be like, oh, this is, we're doing, you know, we sold, you know, 1,000 units today or whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. And also I wanted to ask you, so with where do you see streaming going, because and VOD in general? Because I mean, there's basically the three categories, SVOD, TVOD, and AVOD. AVOD is a very strong place right now for independent film. It's where I see the most revenue being generated for the lower end movies that don't have big stars in it. SVOD, obviously, if you can get the SVOD deals, amazing. If you can get a Netflix deal and a, you know, or a Hulu, nice chunk, awesome. TVOD, unless you drive traffic, is pretty much dead, in my opinion, or has a star involved. Like if you have a star involved, that means people like, you know, if you got John Travolta throw by or Bruce Willis go by, people will probably rent it because of them. But if you don't have that star and you can't drive traffic, TVOD is essentially a dead issue as opposed to where it was 10, 15 years ago. Do you agree?
I have to agree. I think as you said, streaming is SVOD is the holy grail. If you can get a license on a streamer that will pay you up front or even over 2-3 years, great. Transactional and AVOD are a lot more challenging to quantify value. And with transactional, because of the plethora of free content available on AVOD and through AVOD, and yes, it's not free, you have to watch ads, but you know, in terms of the consumer spend, it's time as opposed to cash that they're spending. It in my opinion, it's harder and harder to justify the $4.99 or $7.99 or $9.99 acquisition of a rental or purchase of a movie. The commodity of owning an asset, a movie, I think it, with the younger generation, certainly just doesn't, there's no value to it. Having the box set, I mean, I used to have racks of box sets and
physical media,
alphabetical order, every movie. Dude, I used to go to was, you know,
dude, I had my color coordinated by studio.
Wow.
And they were all VHS.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I was DVD. I'm obviously a little younger than you.
I had DVD too. I'm not that much older than you. But yes.
I was DVD, but there was like, you know, so much joy of picking up the DVD, looking, you know, watching the box sets, the special features,
audio commentaries,
and then seeing them on the wall, like seeing them at the racks. And I did it with CDs as well. It was like my thing. I was almost a bit obsessive. I loved it. Now, I mean, if I have any, I mean, like, I'm like, I can't have anything physical, you know, I can't have paper. I don't like anything. Everything's got to go. So, you know, it's such a different mindset. So, and to me, the idea of renting or purchasing something where it feels like it could be or should be available on one of the many subscription platforms or AVOD, I think it's harder. But I think niche content, and where there's niche audiences, there is going to be a world for clever targeted marketing to be able to drive transactional revenues. Pricing is also a really key thing. You know, we look at transactional, it's actually, I think, probably overpriced, and maybe with the reduction of rental and purchase as a price point, that could also maintain the lifespan of a transactional opportunity. But discovery is the key, Alex. I mean, how do you find this stuff? As we said, everything is available. Everything. Every movie ever made ever is available. So how do you stand out in that crowd? And marketing, discovery, influencers, you know, being able to, you know, market or identify your audience and communicate with them, that's going to be critical.
Yeah. And as filmmakers, I think you've been reading my book. It's about finding that niche audience, creating product for that niche, creating ancillary revenue streams from that movie, all these other things that you can do. I think that is the future for indie filmmakers.
It made me feel like a musician when you were talking like that. And when you talk about it in the book, it made me feel like, how does an indie artist build a career and as a musician in this world? I don't think it's too different to an indie filmmaker. You need to build that fan base, that audience that can travel with you and grow with you. And just like a great indie artist can have a fantastic life and career, putting some music out, going gigging, selling some merch, doing some live appearances, and have a lovely and a pretty good life as long as they build enough momentum. An indie filmmaker can do exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then look at the brands that we follow. I mean, Edgar Wright or Scorsese or Spielberg. Now, mind you, most of those names I just mentioned were built in a different time, and they were basically marketed for free by the studios. So they were able to build their brands off the back of the studios. But there's a lot of independent filmmakers coming up now who, and again, you don't need millions. You just need a core group that love what you do, and you make products that for a certain price, sell it to them, give them access to those films, and you could do it again and again. I've had people like that on my show who've done like 20 movies in the range of from $5,000 movies to $150,000 movies, even sometimes up to $500,000, and they have the same audience following them, and they just keep going, and they've built their careers like that. That is the future. But that's work. And a lot of independent filmmakers want to live in the dream world where Spielberg and Scorsese came up in. And that's not the real world anymore, man. It's not.
Yeah, you say that, but then, you know, you can go and make a really good little indie film and end up with a Marvel movie. So
yes.
you can get plucked out of this little indie pond and put into the sea. It's very
that's the lottery ticket. That's the lottery ticket. That is,
it's not.
You're talking about one in a million, one in 2 million filmmakers get that opportunity. And I always talk about the 90s and the basically independent film as we know it today started in the 90s. There was independent films in the 60s, 70s, 80s, of course, but 90s is what we as a society really kind of grasp independent filmmakers started with the Sundance movement. So with the Richard Linklaters and the Robert Rodriguez's and the Kevin Smiths and all those kind of guys. And I've had the pleasure of speaking to some of these guys, and I talk to them now and I go, so Slacker, would it pop today? You know, would Brothers McMullen pop today? And I, when I talked to Ed, Ed was like, yeah, probably not. It was right place, right time, right movie.
100%. And, you know, I think that's a fast, that is a such, that's the luck, right?
Oh yeah. But right place, right time, right product.
Yeah. All walks of life in any business, in any environment, you know, in any industry, it's about right time, right place, right opportunity, right person, right hustle. You know, I mean, my first job, going back to it, you know, like I was late one day. Something happened because I was stayed late in the office. I worked for this chap called Nick Quested, a fantastic filmmaker in New York. And I was in New York. I'd never been in New York before. I didn't know anyone. So I'm in the office late on my own. And then the phone rings. They got a music video. No one's around. I'm helping write this thing. It pops. Is that luck? Is that hustle? Is that the right timing? Is that because I didn't know anyone in the city? So I ended up being in this, you know, like, what are all the variables that had to happen for that to happen? And you go back and think in all aspects of anything that was positive, ultimately it goes back to that. Story's the star. Start with a great story. You got everything going for you. It's never easy. Every movie, doesn't matter what the budget is, how lucky you are to get the right actor, director, it's hard. There are problems on everyone. And you just got to navigate your way through and conduct all the different components. I mean, this is what I see myself as a producer, a conductor. Mm-hmm. You're conducting all the various moving pieces in this orchestra of a film to try and be hopefully playing the same song in harmony.
Yeah, and it's not easy at all. No, being a producer, and you know, being a producer at the indie level has its own set of issues and challenges. You know, when you're working on a $50,000 movie, which a lot of people are like, how can you make a movie for $50,000? I'm like, I made a movie for $5,000 and sold it to Hulu. So it's possible. But I mean,
that's amazing. That's amazing. I wouldn't know how to do that.
It's a different skill set. No question. Now you throw me in a $200 million project. I'd be like, I probably need some help here, guys. This is not the world. You know, this is a whole other conversation.
You have a lot more money, but that also could mean a lot more problems.
No. And also that's just a different mentality, a different way. It's a different kind of organization, the politics involved, how to work with people. It's a whole other conversation. But you know, depending on what kind of projects you're working on, creates different, the budget levels create different kind of challenges. So you were talking about being an orchestra. You've worked with some pretty remarkable filmmakers over your career, like Martin Scorsese, Rob Reiner, Werner Herzog, Taylor Hackford. How do you conduct Scorsese or Herzog? I'm not saying you're like telling them what to do or anything, but how do you kind of work within that kind of, I mean, these guys, when they walk in a room, their entire catalog walks in the room with them.
and you know, I mean, you mentioned some of the greatest filmmakers that, you know, have ever existed. And you know, filmmaking is a collaboration. Right. When you're working with incredible talent, you know, I'm never the one to put my hand up and say, this is how you do it.
Right.
Especially when I have no clue. I'm not a director. I don't have that skill set. I tried, made a couple of short films. They weren't very good. And I realized quickly that wasn't my skill set. I love the concept of storytelling. I love the ideas and the generation. I love throwing ideas in the pot. But you're not going to tell specialists and experts what they do. In the same way, I wouldn't tell a doctor, what's wrong with me? Because he's the expert.
But I went to WebMD. What are you talking about? I went to WebMD.com. I looked it up. Doc, I need this.
Google Doc. So, in my role as a producer, I'm typically coming in as a financier. So my role is really specific. I help get these films made. I help put them together. But I'm not the guy on the front floor line of production, over the shoulder of the director, giving him a nod, like, you know, what about that angle? Like, firstly, no one does that with some of the talent we're talking about, but it's just not who I am. I am the deal guy. I'm the guy that helps figure out how to put this together. How do you fit this square peg in the round hole with the amount of available resources we have or the challenges we have, and, you know, getting it in that hole and getting that hopefully nice and cohesive flowing relationship between all the parties. So, you know, the relationship I had with some of these directors is honestly, in some cases, very hands off, very polite and wishing them very well. And in some of the ones, it has been a bit more intimate. It does depend very much on the relationship and the challenges and the compromises needing to be made by production. Because the relationship, I believe, between producer and director is that collaborative, you know, you have to share a shared vision, but mm-hmm. sometimes you have different forces. The producer is dealing with strains of capital, money, investors, shareholders, distributors, you know, that kind of thing. And the director is pushing for his vision, that creative force. And sometimes, even where the best one in the world, they're not always aligned.
to say the least.
They're not always aligned. So it's about how do you navigate that workplace? How do you navigate that political, you know, egos, personalities, and also knowing when to shut up and be like, this isn't the time, the place. And I'm not the guy to say anything here because it's not going to make anything better. Right. And try and fix problems. And, you know, producing is problem solving. Producing is finding the problem and identifying it hopefully early and solving it before it's even a problem for someone else.
That's a great, great definition of what a producer does, because producing is such a like kind of nebulous thing. You're like, because anyone can call themselves a producer. You don't have to go to 7 years of school to have, you know, PGA at the end of your at the end of your name as a producer or something like that. To like, you're a producer. Anybody, and trust me, I live in LA, so everybody's a producer here, and everybody walks up and they give you a business card. And I'm like, hey, I'm a producer. I have various projects in multiple stages of development. Of course you do. And all this kind of stuff. And you know,
I'm guys, sure they're all wonderful.
I'm sure they're all fantastic. And it goes, yeah, we've been talking to Marty about this thing. I'm like, I'm sure you have. What have you done before? I've done two shorts. I'm like, that seems like a solid business plan, but that's just the business.
Problem solving. And, you know, part of the first problem is, you know, how do I get this in the hands of someone that could actually pay for it, be in it, direct it? You know, that's the first problem, right? So how do you
develop a project from scratch? How do you approach that problem? And because some movies, I think you're a producer on, and then some of your executive producers on. So some more financiers, some more.
Most co-executive, which is when I'm more involved, as I say, in the financial arrangements and structuring and hopefully deal gathering side. Mm-hmm. But I have, you know, done a number of producing from scratch, like The Foreigner, my film with Jackie Chan, Martin Campbell, was a book that I optioned for, called The Chinaman by Stephen Leather, which I was given by my late father to read when I was a young boy who didn't read. Another thing that, you know, great life lesson, read.
Read a lot.
Read a lot. Read everything. Understand what people are making and why they're getting made. I mean, it's all there for you. You know, anyone who says to me, oh, I don't understand. I got this stuff. It's not, no one's liking it. And they don't read or look at why the things that are getting made. And what were the things that made that happen? But so, yes, I have developed a number of things from scratch.
The Foreigner, if you remind me, The Foreigner is the one with who else was in it besides Jackie?
Jackie Chan, Pierce Brosnan.
That's what I thought. Yeah, I love that film. Loved it. I love that film. Yeah, Jackie was amazing in that film.
My good friend David Marconi, directed by Martin Campbell, who made two Bond movies.
Yeah. Jackie's a legend, man. Like, he's like
a legend.
Like, he's so legendary. How was it working with Jackie on set? Like, because you were a producer on that, so you were on set with that.
I was PGA, whatever that means.
Yeah, whatever that thing. Yeah, exactly. So how was it working with? I mean, a genius. He's a genius.
He is the hardest working and just most unbelievable talent. And Martin Campbell,
Amazing. I love Martin. Oh.
unbelievable director, but he puts actors through their paces. He, you know, again, and he knows what he wants and how he wants it, and he doesn't stop until he gets it. And working with people like Jackie and Piers, it's just amazing to be around such incredible talent. And these guys have made movies for so many years. And when you look at action and the way that Jackie, architects a fight scene and creates that with the stunt crew and with the director, with the idea of the vision of the movie and how the action interrelates, it's incredible to see. And
is he still doing it?
The energy is inspiring. You know, it keeps you going. You look at when a 65-year-old, you know, incredible talent is got the energy and is up and is glowing like that. You know, it lifts everyone around you.
Is he still doing his stunts?
He is.
God.
No. Yeah, he's doing them.
He's nuts.
He is the man. And you know what? He's not just doing them. You're designing the sequences and the fight, the fights around them as well, which is just so much work. And the meticulous attention to detail that goes into everything you see is exceptional. It blew my mind. It absolutely blew my mind.
Wow. Amazing
people. And the whole crew that go with him,
I've heard. Yeah, his legendary, his team.
Just amazing.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you as a financier, because this is the biggest dilemma filmmakers have when they're packaging a project. It's the chicken and egg dilemma. I need cast before I can get money, but I need money to get cast. How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, fake it till you make it. No, I don't. It's really hard. It's super hard. Even when you've made a bunch of movies, the difference is when you say you can fund or you can pay someone something, you know, there's a little more believability in it maybe now for me. Sure. So if I'm calling an agent or an actor and saying, listen, we'd like to make an offer and, you know, this is what we can pay, you know, I'm only doing that knowing that I can deliver that. Obviously when you're starting, you may eat the chicken egg. You know that if you're able to land X actor, the finances will come rolling. It's really hard. I mean, increasingly, it's getting even harder because the competition with film and TV as well now. And I wish I had an answer for you. The only thing I can say is the great stories rise to the top. Actors gravitate towards great roles, great parts, and great stories. And so, in my view, you have to, if you can't afford the number, you have to position the project as a must-do project. It's not about the money. Now, that won't be music to the agent's ears, but for the actor who may be getting, you know, a dozen opportunities a month or more, they want to do things that are going to move their, you know, their career forward or move their
value. Their value as an actor.
But even just their interests. And so think about who you're going after and why this part, this role, this movie will mean something to them, because you can't just dangle the check that's going to make them pay attention. It's got to be centered around the part and the role. And I think dressing up offers with really personalized letters and visions from the director, because ultimately the director's vision is key when approaching talent. And so, you know, really be creative about how you position your movie and the opportunity to the actor. Do a video of the director talking to the actor like he's in the room, pitching the role. Is he more likely to watch a 3-minute video or read your email and script? Maybe he might just read he might watch the 3-minute video. I don't know. Maybe not. But it might stand out over the email. It might stand out over the whole script. So get them into the story. Get them looking at the part and fake it. You know, the money's good. We got the money. It's coming. We got it.
Now, there's so many, you know, and I run this, I ran into this so much in my career, and I was this early on in my career, you probably were a little bit as well, is the delusional factor, where you are like that guy I was just making fun of, like I was like, oh yeah, I got this card, I'm a producer, and I'm, yeah, I'm talking to Marty, and like, there's this delusional factor, and there's a lot of this goes on, and some of it is very conscious, like I'm just trying to boast myself up, fake it till you make it kind of scenarios, and then there's people who really, truly are delusional, like completely delusional about like, I'm going to pick, I've had conversations. Yeah. We're pitching this to Tom Cruise. I'm like, are you crazy? Like that's, but that's the delusion. Like, oh, this is the part for him. It's going to be the thing. And I'm like, guys, look at the track record.
I say that, but when I started, I was 25 years old and I approached Jackie Chan to be in a movie that had no money, really. It had nothing. But I knew, you know, I had a 65-year-old Asian lead that there was only really four or five actors in the world that could play this part, and he was number one. He was number one. And so you knock on the door and you try. And actually, I should tell you, the first time, it was a no. It took time and tenacity and hustle and staying with it, and also talking to Donnie Yen and Andy Lau and Chow Yun-fat and going through the process to eventually have all the right things in place to then end up closing the deal.
How many years did that take?
From first trying to attack, because we took a few years to write and adapt the book to the script, because I was, again, I had no money, and I had an amazing writer in David Marconi who wrote Enemy of the State, Mission Impossible 2, you know, fantastic array of movies. And it wasn't being paid, which is not unreasonable. But I had to kind of piecemeal it together. So that took a couple of years. But by the time we finally started the journey of packaging, I think it took about 3 years.
From the moment you started to the moment you attached Jackie?
From the moment I had a script I could go out with.
Right. And then how long did it take you before, from beginning of the project to the very end when you're shooting?
7 years.
7 years. Okay. So I don't consider that delusional. You're going for it at that point, and then you actually are creating things that make that happen, as opposed to, here's a script, Tom Cruise. You should understand that I'm a genius and you need to work with me. That's the delusion. And I'm sure you've run into these guys.
No, I mean, I'm probably one of these guys, right? Because at times, but it works, right? But no, you're right. And I think that, you remember earlier we were talking about what is the right, framework for this movie. It's the same as distribution. It's the same as talent. It's the same as amount of money you're raising. Don't raise a $1 million movie and try and get Tom Hardy. I mean, it's never going to work. You know, it's not the right fit. Go and get the best person in that kind of category of budget and everything, because just having a major star on a movie has its costs that come with it, let alone the fee for them. There is a certain amount of costs that come with just having major talent along with a movie.
Yep.
And that's, you know, just because you've got a little bit of money isn't always enough. So I think it is always about positioning yourself with the right and approach. That doesn't mean you shouldn't aim high. That doesn't mean you shouldn't have aspirations to go for the best.
Correct.
And that doesn't mean you shouldn't try and hustle. But there is a, if you're trying to make, you know, as you say, hits at the biggest and the best, you know, A, you've got to be prepared to wait a long time, because you've got to be patient. When you're dealing with people that are the best in an industry, in any industry, they're busy. They're good at what they do. They're going to be busy. You are not a priority. So if you're happy to wait, then great. But there's pressure with waiting. And, you know, it eats you. So you've got to be doing a lot of things, juggling a lot of balls, or manage your expectations. Be real, be practical, and get it. And my view would be, isn't it worth just getting this made and making another one, and maybe in 3 or 4 movies, because you've gone from 2 million to 5 million to 9 million to 50 million. Now you're doing the 40 million film with Tom Cruise.
Well, Tom's not doing 40 million, but... But
you come in and say hi.
He might come in and say hi. Yeah, absolutely. Depends on who the director is, and you never know. I know, of course. Now, Would you recommend reaching out to actors directly through their production companies and seeing if that's an angle of like bringing them into the financial, bringing them into as a producer, because that might be more appetizing as opposed to just going directly through agents?
Absolutely. I would be trying every angle possible to try and position myself as a project that should be on the radar of the target actor, whether it be through their production entity, through their agent, through their management, through the guy that's the valet at the best restaurant they go to. If there is a route in, you got to try and navigate. That's the hustle, right, Alex? It's about getting in the door, okay? I was involved in a film called War with Grandpa.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic story. And the producer of that film had the best hustle story of how he got the script to De Niro. Mm-hmm. And he just was relentless and wouldn't accept no. And then he would, you know, leave them everywhere and hand them to everyone around him. And ultimately, eventually, De Niro read it, needed, you know, basically engaged in the project, although there was a lot of work that had to be done before he attached. But it got through a process and boom, he's in the film. His number one choice. Was it easy? No. Did he hustle it? Yes. It was commendable. And I find that those stories are inspiring. They make me feel like great about life, because you're like, yes, there is a way. You don't have to always have, you know, buckets of cash and, you know, be perfect. You can do it, and it isn't easy. But yes, of course. If you feel, but go in smart. Look at what the slate is. Look at what they gravitate towards. Don't go and send Jake Gyllenhaal's production company something that he would never gravitate towards, and they've never made, they're never associated with. Do your homework, research, understand what these businesses and people are doing and making. And it's not always easy, but there is so much information available on the web. And there's so much access to information now that the more prepared you can be to go in, to engage with anyone, director, producer, financier, do your homework.
Now, you mentioned something a little bit ago, which I really doesn't get talked about as much. But if you're lucky enough to get one of these guys or gals who come onto your show, a named talent, you're like, great, I raised $1 million and I'm paying X star to show up for 5 days for $1 million. And you're like, solid. But then you forget that with that, they're not going to sit in a chair and drink, you know, Kool-Aid. Like, you got to get them a trailer. There's going to probably be an entourage. There's going to probably be... So there's cost involved. And I've seen other producers that are like, oh, we weren't ready for this. It killed our budget because... You know, Nick Cage showed up, not saying that's Nick Cage, but Nick Cage showed up. Someone like Nick Cage showed up. He's like, I need, what's my trailer? What is that? I can't go in that. Like, yeah. All these things that you're not aware of.
You're absolutely right. And look, everyone is different. And,
of course.
You know, fair to generalize, but there is an associated and an expected level of
professionalism
and support, you know. You don't change in the back of a room where there's a little curtain if you are, you know, in the middle of nowhere. You need a private place with a, you know, with a place for them to, you know, have, you know, do what they do, get in the zone, prep. 100%. The support and the budgeting requirements that go with any major talent is often under thought of in independent film production.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's a shame because, you know, in some respects it's like, well, it seems like a waste, but it's not. You can't look at it like that. It's about professionalism, and trust me, they will feel better. They will come on set, you know, free, ready to work, ready to bear, you know, do what you want them to do in the best shape. And the challenge comes, I find, not always about, you know, packaging for the major star that's coming, but then how that you know, that affects the rest of the cast and the rest of the crew who may, You know what I mean? Like, because you're like, okay, well, we threw all the bells and whistles out for so-and-so. And then the rest of you, you're in there, mate. You know, you're in the bus. We've got a bus for you. All of you can sit in the bus. It's great. It's warm.
It's not air conditioned. It's not air conditioned, though.
It's not it. It's not air conditioned. But there's fans. We've got fans.
You got brown bag lunches. So while he's eating,
I think it's about thinking about the overall. And the other things is just have a conversation. Again, communication is key. The biggest mistake to make is just assume it will be okay. That's the mistake. It's okay to say, listen, we don't have the budget for this. We're going to make you as comfortable as possible. This is our proposal. This is how we're going to do it. Is that going to be okay? We can give a bit here, but we can't do that. Communicate. As soon as you just assume, well, they'll turn up, we'll be all right. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. Yeah.
That's where the problems happen. That's when you get people with their back up and you're off to a bad start.
Right. And that's the thing that a lot of people don't talk about either, is just the politics of all of this. This is psychology. This is human behavior. You're being almost a politician on how to negotiate egos and agendas. And, you know, maybe they had a bad night the night before and how you have to deal with that. Like, I always ask my hairdressers and my hair and makeup department, I'm like, how are they doing? Because they're the first ones to hear what happened. Right. They're the first ones to hear what happened the night before. Like, oh, I had a fight with my girlfriend, or, oh, my boyfriend cheated on me. Like, okay, you want to know these things before they step on set. So I always ask my hair and makeup department that kind of stuff. But that is something that, so how do you, you know.
You can get it. Driver as well, you know, yeah, the pickup driver, you know, they're always great. Was he talkative on the way in this morning? Did she have a coffee?
And this is the weird, and it's just an insane world that we live in the movie business, where our entire, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars on the day, are riding on, did they have their coffee? Sometimes.
You know, you're throwing together a collective of personalities and experiences in one go and hoping it all gels together to make this magic. Right. And sometimes it comes together and it's beautiful and everyone's like, you're my best friends. I will love you forever. Right, yes. I'm going to see you at my wedding. And others, you're like, I never want to hear from you again. Please don't call. I don't care how good the job is. I'm not interested. You're a nightmare. It's a complete concoction. Right. And, you know, even when you do every film's different. And that's also awesome as well. That's one of the most magical things about what we do and how and the world we're in, is that you meet amazing people and you work with amazing people who are brilliant at what they do. But sometimes it clicks and sometimes it doesn't. And the personalities arriving and where all the eyes are focusing and all the attention is focusing can gel together beautifully, and they can be really not. And managing those situations is also a really important job of the director and potentially the producers as well, to really hope for the best result. Because it's one thing coming and doing the job, mm-hmm. reading the lines, turning up, you know, putting in a good day's work, but it's another thing coming and like shining in that day. And as a filmmaker and as a producer, as an owner of a business and an asset, you want everyone to shine. So how do you create a working environment to nurture that and support that and encourage it?
And that's why I love that you keep saying business and asset, because it's something I've been yelling from the top of the mountains for a long time. And filmmakers a lot of times get caught up with the magic of it's art, it's story. And we are in this crossroads between business, it's show and business. And as a producer friend of mine says, and as a producer friend of mine says, the word business has twice as many letters as the word show, and there's a reason. Because it is this art form mixed with business, and a lot of the artists just want to focus on the art and the business want to focus on the business, and we have to find this happy balance, happy medium. But you have to, as a filmmaker, keep thinking, this is a business first. We're creating an art form within the realm of a business, of an asset that is going to be sold in the marketplace. And you have to think that way. And all the greats, all those directors I just mentioned, from Herzog and Scorsese, and they all understand it. They're amazing artists, but they understand the business of it.
They do. And you know why? Because you respect the fact it's a business and you keep getting the work. You keep getting the opportunity to make more. It's not a hobby. It can be a hobby. It can be
an expensive hobby.
Wonderful. But it's but then treat it like a hobby. Then make films for fun and enjoy the process and don't worry about the monetization. That's all upside if it happens, but that's not the thing. But the majority of us in this industry live by what we make. We support our families by how well we do with our work. And therefore, in the same respect you'd have for a teacher turning up to teach your kids or a doctor going to look at, you know, your thing or a mechanic fixing your car, we are making movies, we're making assets that hopefully will entertain wide audiences, and that's great. But the aim of the aim for me anyway is to make something for less than you get for when you sell it. That's got to be the aim.
That's business. That's just business. I had a conversation with a filmmaker at AFM, and they ran up to me and they're like, Alex, I got a deal. I got an MG. I'm like, great. What was your MG? Like, we got $35,000 MG. I'm like, fantastic. What was your budget? He's like, it was $250,000. I'm like, okay. So what rights
You're on the way.
What rights did you sell? All of them. Okay. How long? 9 years. And they were ecstatic about it. They're like, we sold it. We got it. I'm like, but that's not what business in the world does that make sense? Like that's a hobby camp. That's a hobby.
Alex,
but
that's the hobby camp. And you know, it's hard. And you know what we're in is we're in a brutal industry. It costs a lot. The barrier to entry, although technology and cost of production are down, the barrier to entry is high. The competition is vast. And whilst there arguably has never been a better time to make a movie and get it exploited and distributed, because of the likes of AVOD, because of the direct distribution channels to an audience, which is amazing and a wonderful opportunity. It's super difficult. It's super hard. And, you know, focus on story, building the best version of whatever that story is, then find the right director and talent that will enhance that project. That doesn't mean it has to be the megastar. It needs to be the right level. And then financing it appropriately to what that package looks like.
Now, you did a movie called 47 Meters Down, which I remember when it came out and it exploded. It was like a huge box office hit. And it, you know, arguably, I'm a fan of Mandy Moore. I watched This Is Us. I love Mandy, but she's not a huge box office star. She's not bringing in tons of cash. But yet this movie exploded and it was like on a $5 million budget or something like that, if I read correctly. Tell me the story behind that. That must have been amazing.
So Mark Lane and James Harris came to me with the project. They had already shot a promo with Johannes, the director, that was, you know, a minute and a half visual effects promo of a shark, basically.
Sure.
And it was brilliant. And I guess this promo cost them $40,000, $35,000, $40,000. And they had got this amazing visual effects house in the UK, in Bournemouth, that were new and hungry. And they put this together and they went to Cannes or Berlin and they pre-sold the movie by about $2.5 million straight away. And then
off of a shark.
Engine, the Weinsteins bought it for $1 million off. A promo and a script and a director. That's it. No talent at this stage.
Right.
And so they were looking to find a way to finance the film. And, you know, as was the kind of focus of me, you know, what I was doing back then, lending against these pre-sale distribution contracts, a UK tax credit, and then putting up some, if you like, gap or equity against the rest of the world, felt like a smart play given the amazing work that the pre and Altitude were the film sales agent. They did a terrific job off this promo, and so we made a deal. We worked with them to finance the movie and produce the film, and they executed a terrific movie. And I would say that at the time, you know, Bob Weinstein would, you know, feedback his notes, and everyone was looking good about a big theatrical release. And then we got to finishing the movie, and I remember we were in Cannes, we screened it for them privately, as we did to some of the buyers, and they turned around and said, no, we're not going to release it. It's going to go straight to DVD. And we were bummed. We thought we had a great movie. We obviously were, you know, not relying, but really hopeful that the theatrical release would really give us the upside we all were counting on. And so we managed to negotiate a deal where we could buy back the rights from North America. And by the way, they were phenomenal at the time. Bob, the notes he gave, they invested more money to do reshoots. We made a great move, but they just decided it wasn't going to get a release. So we managed to have a window of time to rebuy the movie by repaying their investment and their MG and a little uplift, a significant uplift. But the condition was we couldn't sell to any of their competitors. That's a really, I mean, so no studio, no what they got as a competitor, no Lionsgate, none of that. So we ended up having to have a very narrow pool of almost independent distributors, smaller distributors, and we did a screening, and amazingly, we managed to get the attention of Byron Allen. Mm-hmm. And he and his team there just jumped on it. They loved it. They saw the potential of this film. And but the Weinsteins decided that they were always going to release the movie on a certain date. And we had till that day to buy it back. And the thing was dragging. We got to release day, and the DVD dropped. It was in Target, it was in Walmart, it was everywhere. On the day we dropped the movie, we bought the movie back. Byron went with a check down the beach and gave a check, got the deal done. We recalled the movie 5 hours later off the shelves, and then rebuilt the whole movie up a year later to do the theatrical release.
Wow.
It was one of the most crazy experiences I've ever been involved with. Right. The stress and the excitement. And then Byron and his team did an unbelievable job. They put up a stupid amount of P&A money for a tiny little movie. They went everywhere and he went nuts. And, you know, we also had the benefit in that year that This Is Us dropped. Mandy Moore suddenly, who was always a great actress, but suddenly became a star overnight, like within the year while we were messing around with all this stuff. And that helped us a lot. And Claire Holt as well. I mean, we just had an amazing, amazing achievement. And Johannes did a phenomenal job, went on to make a sequel. It was just one of those amazing stories. But it came together really by the smart approach that the filmmakers took to make a 35, 30, 40 grand promo of a minute and a half of a shark that looked amazing, that just basically pitched this story and managed to pre-sell the movie off the back of it with no talent.
That's insane.
Significant pre-sales.
Yeah.
And actually, it's an amazing opportunity that if you have, you know, the right kind of genre and the right kind of movie, it can be a fantastic strategy to raise 5 million, 7 million for a movie off the back of a killer promo, a killer trailer. And actually, so that small seed investment to really create a sizzle to then go and sell it in the market can be a fantastic solution. But an amazing story.
That's a lottery ticket.
When we had to call people that legitimately bought the DVD in Target and tell them they had to send it back to us.
How did really?
Because we recalled every DVD because it and it wasn't called 47 Meters Down. It was called Into the Deep, they called it. Okay. And so we had to recall every DVD. We were getting piracy things going everywhere. We had to recall all that. We had a year of with all of this story. It was amazing. But, you know, to
what
the credit.
What an amazing story. What an amazing. That's not happened. There's nothing like that happens.
And I Someone sent me, I don't even know if I've got one here. I'd love to, I don't know where I've got it, but literally you go into a Target, you could have bought it off the shelf legitimately in the morning, and by the afternoon it was gone. Gone. A year later, you could see it in the cinema. It was fun.
That's amazing. Now I want to ask you a few, questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Don't do it. Go and do something.
Just
go.
I mean, be an accountant. Be an accountant. Go bake a cookie.
I've drummed on this a lot today, but story's the star. Focus on story. Build the best version of whatever it is. Spend the time in script. Spend the time in really, really believing in what you're making. And make sure that when you do get the opportunity and you do get in front of that actor, don't blow it. Be prepared. Research, be prepared.
Okay. And what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
I would say that happiness is not the destination, but the journey.
Amen.
And I think I struggled for many years in the destination and trying to get that happiness and that hit and that adrenaline. But actually you look back over your shoulder, and we talked a bit about some of the experiences today, but that's the joy. The journey is the joy. So enjoy the ride, enjoy the journey, enjoy the no's, enjoy the yeses. And the success comes from the journey and not arriving at the destination.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, God. This is your podcast, and here I am, not knowing what to say. The Station Agent.
Yeah, great movie. Great movie.
I would say, I love some of The Rock, I would say, is one of my favorite all-time action movies.
Can we stop there for a second? I've said this before and I'll say it again. Whether you like Michael Bay or not, Michael Bay changed the way action films are made. Just like Tony Scott did when Tony Scott showed up. Before Tony Scott, and there's after Tony Scott. Before Michael Bay and after Michael Bay. Before The Matrix and after The Matrix. There are certain movies that change the way they do it. The Rock, he touches it in Bad Boys, but The Rock is the film that... And it's my favorite.
The definitive action movie of my youth. Made me love action movies the way I love them.
And it's a solid story, and it's amazing solid action.
And the lines, and just the relationship.
Oh, Sean Connery. It's amazing. And if you want a little bit more cheese, you can go watch Armageddon, which I also enjoy, but at a different level. All right, and your third one.
Most recently, I think, I loved Parasite as well. Recent years. But yeah, I mean, I love movies. I love all films. I mean, I like bad movies. I like good movies. I just love that the escapism of our craft.
Did you see The Room? You've seen The Room, right?
Of course,
The Room, right? The Room is a genius film, and everyone listening to the podcast knows I'm just a fanatic of The Room and of Tommy Wiseau and everything that movie has done. But did you see it by yourself or did you see it with other people? Because
I'm probably other people.
Yeah, because that's a movie you can't watch by yourself. You need to watch it with a group, especially if you're a filmmaker, with a group of filmmakers. I saw it with a group of filmmakers at Sundance one night in a loft while we were shooting my movie there. And no one on the crew had seen it except for me. I'm like, oh, we're getting it tonight. And we're all watching it. And everyone's just sitting there going, is he using the same stock footage shot twice? Why is he humping her stomach? What's going on? Like, there's so much going on in that movie. It is so brilliantly bad.
What are your top three? Is that one of them?
No. Well, I mean, it's the best worst movie I've ever seen. You just enjoy it. I always tell people this. I'm like, there's bad, and then there's bad that transcends good. So it gets so bad that it is good, and you can't go after that. It happens naturally. You can't make a bad movie and hope that people will love it because the intention is wrong. The reason why The Room is beloved by millions around the world is because Tommy Wiseau was trying to make the greatest film of all time. That is why it is so brilliant. But when you try to make a cult film or a bad movie, people understand.
You're never gonna do it.
But because there was such sincerity in the making of it, and it's like, I can't, don't get me started. I'm only seeing his lines and scenes flying into my head. That's the brilliance of it.
Up a little bit, Alex.
Oh, yeah. You there?
Sorry, yeah, I'm back.
So for me, I always, my favorites are, I always say, the three that I could just throw off the top today, Shawshank, Fight Club, and The Matrix. I mean, they work, and of course The Godfather, and of course Raiders of the Lost Ark, and of course Jaws, and of course Taxi Driver, and of course all these other amazing films. But those are the three that, like, they're remote control throwaways. Like if you're watching something, you're like, oh, it's on, gone. I just have to watch it, you know. But
I love those sort of movies where no matter where you land in them, you immediately can pick them up like that.
Yeah, and Fight Club and
timeless,
and of course everything Kubrick, and what was anything Kubrick made. I'm a huge, ridiculous Kubrick fan. One day I'll make the pilgrimage to England to the archives there at the school, and
we'll take you to a football game.
I can't wait. Now, can you tell people where they can find out more about Purely Capital?
Amazingly, purely.capital. It's just all in the title. So find us on Purely and all your social medias, but all means, check us out, purely.capital. And if you have any long-dated contracted revenues, we will happily let you get them sooner. Anyone got, any ideas about how to improve lack of transparency around our industry, we're also excited to hear about those sorts of ideas so we can try and help build products that will give you those tools.
Wayne, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. And thank you so much for coming on the show. And I hope this episode helps a few people. We've thrown out a lot of information, and a lot of information I'm sure you would have liked to have known 20 years ago. And I definitely would have liked to know 20 years ago.
You know what? The best thing, to look at today is that we are in, an established industry that is still finding its feet and changing today. And that's what's amazing, and tomorrow will be different. So just keep hustling, right?
Amen, brother. Thank you, bro.
Thank you for having me.
I want to thank Wayne for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you again so much, Wayne. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/482. And if you haven't already, you got to check out our new webinar, How to Cast Bankable Stars in Your Indie Films. It's a fantastic webinar you should definitely check out. Just head over to www.ifhacademy.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.